The subject is God's irresistible grace. I was a student of eschatology much earlier than I was a student of the doctrines of grace. And when I came across the doctrines of grace, I already had a rather complete eschatological scheme going on in my head that I believed and continue to believe is biblically based. And one of the things that I really liked about eschatology and the reason that I studied it to the depth that I did was that it continued to show the absolute sovereignty and control of God over all things. I came to the conclusion and wrote in one of my books, prophecy works because the future is definite. The only reason that prophecy does work is because the future can't do anything other than what God declared it's going to do. Do you understand that? And that when you think about God and the way God works in prophecy, he doesn't work the way Gene Dixon does. You know, he doesn't predict what's going to happen. He declares what's going to happen. He says, I've decided that it's going to happen like this, and then declares in advance what is going to happen. And then those things happen exactly the way he said they were going to happen, because he is, after all, in control. He's God. He's sovereign. So when I first came across the concepts of the sovereignty of God, I had no problem with them at all. That was very much the God I knew, the God who was in control of human history. When I then read that he was soteriologically also in control, or that he was in control of all the aspects of a person's salvation, that didn't shake me up at all. I was able to embrace that immediately because that was very much in keeping with the God that I already knew, who was the God who declared the end from the beginning. Listen to this. You don't have to turn to it, but this is Isaiah 46, verses 8 to 10. This is God telling you about himself. Every so often, God shows up in Scripture and just says, let me tell you about me. Let me reveal myself to you in some greater capacity than I have up until now. And he says things like this about himself. Remember this, says God, and show yourselves men. I like that. The first thing he does is say, okay, now stand up like men and show yourself, because I got something to tell you. And our job is to just stand there and go, uh-oh, God is going to tell us something about himself. He says, remember this, show yourselves men, bring it again to your mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. That's why he started out with the first commandment. What's the first commandment? There are no other gods before me. I'm God, there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, he says behind that. And then to prove that there is no other like him, he says, I declare the end from the beginning. And from ancient times, I declare the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my good pleasure. That's how God represents himself. The only God you find in the Bible is the one who says, I will do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it. I will do all my good pleasure, regardless of how much relative pleasure it does or does not bring to you. I will accomplish all my will, and I will declare it from the beginning just to prove that I am God. I'm going to declare what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to set about to doing it, and your job is to stand there like men and watch me. Stand up like a man while I tell you who I am. I'm God. There's nobody like me. I do whatever I want to do. Now, most folk, even our Arminian friends and brethren, I use that term very widely and loosely, and I thought rather generously. They don't have a problem with this idea that God is in control of some stuff. You know, big things, wars, famines, plagues of locusts, getting Israel out of Egypt. They'll say, well, God was definitely involved in that. You know, clearly God was right there when that happened. But when you bring it down to the details of life, when you bring it down to perhaps the most important detail of your life, heaven or hell, lost or saved, salvation or destruction, eternity with God or eternal damnation, for some reason, that's where they extricate him. And that's the place where he most ought to be. He most ought to be involved in your salvation, right? And yet we'll have folks out there saying, well, no, that That would encroach on a man's free will. That's their instant argument. That would encroach on a man's free will. You can't have God going around making people act opposed to their own will. We'll get to that when we get to the arguments. But here you have God saying, I do all my will. I do all my good pleasure. So, if he has determined that he's going to, encroach on Jeff's life, attract Jeff to himself, put Jeff to work in his kingdom, decide that Jeff now belongs to him and Jeff's life will be devoted to his work, does God have any right to do that, regardless of what Jeff thinks? According to this, he does. Jeff is to stand there while God declares, I will do all my will. I will do all my good pleasure. And I've declared these things from ancient times. Long before you ever got here, Jeff, I determined that I was going to do these things. Why would you want to extricate God's absolute sovereignty? We'll get to these things when we get to the arguments again. But I had somebody just this week say to me, well, the way you talk about salvation, then you know, I'm just like a robot or something. I said, well, no, actually, it's not robot. A lot of people tell me, well, then I'm a puppet. I'm just a puppet, you know, have no choice in these things. I say, well, somebody's pulling your strings. Better it be God, you know, it's going to be the devil or it's going to be God. I prefer God. But you still aren't using the proper analogy. The biblical analogy is not that you're a robot or a puppet. The biblical analogy is that you're a dead man. Dead in trespasses and sins and completely incapable of helping yourself. Completely incapable of taking the first step toward God or doing anything that would please God. That's the biblical analogy, is that if you're a robot, there's no batteries and you're rusted. And if you're a puppet, the strings are snipped and you're just laying in a heap somewhere. People get the impression that when God saves them, they somehow become robotic or puppets. When in fact it's just the opposite. You go from being dead to being alive. You go from being incapable to being capable. The point is you have no ability to praise God, to worship God, to please God, to move toward God. He frees you from your slavery. That's the other word. He said he that commits sin is a slave of sin. There's the proper analogy. You want a good analogy? Okay, you're a slave. I don't want to be a puppet. Okay, be a slave. I don't want to be a robot. Okay, you're a slave to sin. Dead in trespasses and sin. Those are your only options. Use biblical language to talk about biblical things. So you're dead in trespasses and sins, you're a slave to your sins, and Christ is going to free you to actually worship God in spirit and truth and move from life into life. And you object to that notion? You object to the idea of God empowering you to become everything he's ordained you to be because that would make you like a puppet? Doesn't hold much weight with me. As far as I'm concerned, if someone's going to pull my strings, I'd rather it be God. And I got tired of that slavery that I was in to sin because I know what it is to be a slave to sin. That's a different story. Isaiah 55. Check this out. Isaiah 55 verses 10 and 11. For as the rain comes down, and as the snow comes down from heaven and then doesn't return back up, he's building a parallel here. He's saying, you know that the rain comes down and hits the ground. You know that the snow comes down and hits the ground, but then it doesn't go back up. It only comes down. He said, well, then that rain comes down and waters the earth, and it makes it bring forth the buds and the herbs, that it will give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. In the same way, my word that goes forth out of my mouth, it shall not return unto me void. That means empty, of no use, of no purpose. It will not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereunto I sent it. There's God talking about himself again. And God says, my word, once it leaves my mouth, once I declare a thing, it will not come back to me empty. It will not come back ineffective. It will accomplish the very thing that I decided it would accomplish. Do you get that? The God that you find in the Bible is the one who declares these kind of things about himself. I am in absolute control, and whatever I say goes. I declare the end from the beginning. Many years ago, by the way, Tom and I had a discussion about this very thing. We were talking about God's right to choose, I think was the context. You can correct me if I'm wrong, if you remember. And he said, I don't think it was ever a question of right, because we all kind of have some intrinsic ability to make choices. It becomes a question of power. Do you have the power to enact your choices? If you don't have the power to act on your choices, then your ability to choose is senseless, right? For instance, I may choose to be king of England. And doggone it, I do. From this day forth, I tell you, I can choose to be king of England, but I don't have the power to go take the throne. So my choice is meaningless. I may choose to fly and get up on the roof and run like the Dickens toward the end of this building and leap off. But I'm not going to fly because I lack the power to fly. Do you understand what I'm talking about? God is the only person, the only being in the universe who represents himself as being all-powerful. He says, I have all the power. That means that everything that happens in his universe is necessarily empowered by him. Nothing can happen in his universe that he does not empower. Otherwise, there is some other power in the universe separate from him, and then chaos ensues. Jeremiah went so far as to say that the lot is cast into the lap. That's no different than taking a pair of dice and casting it down. You're playing the game of life, and you really need a 7, and you throw down the dice, and you get a 3. Oh, I'm losing the game. Turns out Jeremiah said, that's up to God. The lot is cast into the lap, and then he says, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. David went so far as to say, you know my uprisings, you know my downsittings, you know the thoughts and intentions of my heart, you know my words before I speak them, while they're still on my tongue, you know what I'm going to say. That's the kind of power and the kind of presence that God has in his universe. So then if he has all the power, he naturally then has all the choices, right? Because he's the only one who has the power to enact his choices, which is why he would say, I declare the end from the beginning. I declare the way it's going to go, and then I set to work with all my power, making sure that what I declared comes to pass. And then we rise up, silly little humans that we are, whose lives is like a vapor, whose life is in our nostrils, to use Jeremiah's language. You know, if you don't take your next breath, you're dead. You're alive, one nostril full of air at a time, and yet we walk around thinking that we're going to shake our fists at God and tell him how it's going to be. We go to the all-powerful and we say, I will not have this man to rule over me. No, I'm going to throw down God from his throne. And you're a vapor, you're nothing. You're like the grass that is here today and withers away tomorrow, all that kind of language. And yet human beings think that their free will, supposedly, their right to choose is superior to God's right to choose. And that if God chooses Tom, that somehow Tom's equal authority to choose can supersede God's right to choose. That Tom can say, no, I've opted to not go to heaven, even though you've chosen me. I cast off your choice because I don't want to be a robot. I don't want to be your puppet to go find someone else. That's ridiculous. You don't find that kind of thinking anywhere in the Bible, as we're going to see. Philippians 2, 12 and 13 says, wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God which works in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. You understand that language? He said, it is God who works in you to cause you not only to do God's pleasure, but to will to do God's pleasure. He determines what his pleasure is. He determines what you're going to do that is in keeping with his good pleasure, and then he puts in you the power to do it and the will to do it. You see that? It's funny that even the people who, in Paul's writing in Romans 9, that even the people who object to the notion of God's sovereignty still admit to this fact. In his polemic, as he's building his diatribe, which is a series of questions and answers, he actually at one point says, well, then you will say to me, how does God yet find fault, seeing as no one has resisted his will? Even the people who are arguing get Paul's point. Paul's point couldn't be clearer, that no one has resisted God's will. And people will say, well, that's not fair. No one has resisted his will. Why do they yet find fault? Remember what his answer was? Who are you to reply against God? That's his answer. He reverts to God's sovereignty and says, you still can't argue with God. No one resists his will. It is God that works in you to will and to do all his good pleasure. And sometimes, by the way, his good pleasure may not match your good pleasure. Your good pleasure and his may be at odds. Guess whose good pleasure is going to get done? His. Because he will work in you to will and to do all his good pleasure. Ephesians 1, 4 to 6, I'm just giving you a sense of God's representation of himself for a second, and then we will get to Acts real quick. We'll call it a morning. Ephesians 1, 4 to 6, you know, I love the first two chapters of the book of Ephesians. There is no clearer statement of God's absolute sovereignty and salvation. But 4 to 6 says, according as he, God, has chosen us in Christ, before the foundation of the world, that alone, there's a remarkable statement. God has chosen us who believe, chosen us in Christ before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy, that is separated, without blame, fully justified, righteous, before him in love, having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself. Why? According to the good pleasure of his will. There it is again. God keeps saying it. Old Testament, New Testament, I don't care where you go. God keeps saying, I do everything according to my will, and even the salvation of any one individual still comes down to my good pleasure. He predestined us to the adoption of sons through Jesus Christ according to his good pleasure. See that? According to the good pleasure of his will, to the praise and the glory of his grace, wherein he has made us accepted in the beloved. Who did all the work there? He did. Why? Because he has all the power. Why? It's his will. What's our job? Stand up like men and accept it. All right, Acts 16, 14. Let's go there real quick. And then we're going to read one story about Saul of Tarsus, and we'll call it a morning. Look at Acts 16, 14. This is a remarkable little blurb. The book of Acts is full of these kind of blurbs. Like the comment that those men who killed Jesus all did according to their will, and yet they did exactly what God had foreordained would be done. Men acting according to their own choices and will and killing Jesus, and yet doing exactly what God foreordained would be done. And then, of course, it says that God added daily to the church such as should be saved. These kind of statements that intrinsic, inherent to these verses, inherent to this language. As Luke is writing, he's making sure that we understand that it is always God's sovereignty that is responsible for people being saved. But look at this one nice little verse, this woman Lydia. There was a certain woman named Lydia, this is Acts 16, 14. A certain woman named Lydia, who was a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, which worshipped God, she heard us, that's Luke talking about his travels with Paul, whose heart the Lord opened that she attended unto the things which were spoken of by Paul. That even in the smallest things, like a woman sitting down and listening to the gospel, he said that was the work of the Lord. Because he is the all-powerful. Nobody empowered themselves to sit down under the gospel and understand it. It was the power of God that caused her to sit down and understand it. Isn't that great? Why are you sitting here now? We have a couple women sitting here under the gospel. Why are you sitting here now? If you understand anything that's being taught out of the word, it's because God himself opened your heart to attend to this word and to understand what was being taught. Don't ever take that for granted. We get our minds so messed up that we actually think that we're doing God a favor when we go to church and attend his word. And we actually want credit for it. You know, like we did something. Hey, well, I got up out of bed on a Sunday and I was really tired, but I got there by golly. Or then they'll use that same language as an excuse not to go. Well, we're kind of busy, and well, the children, and well, the car, and I really need to paint the thing, and I've really got a lot of cleaning to do, and I got... Not understanding that it is an absolute privilege to go attend his word, and that he is active in your heart and moving on you to do his good pleasure and to do all his will, and he is opening your heart to attend to his word, and you'd rather push that off and say, no, I have to clean the kitchen floor. I have things to do that are more important than the privilege that God gave me to come attend his word. And people use excuses to get out of that? please. Stand up like men and attend his word. Or women, as the case may be. All right, look over at Acts 7, as long as we're there. Whenever I talk about whether the grace of God is resistible, I always start with Saul of Tarsus. We only have a few examples in the Bible of God converting people. We hear about it after the fact that certain people were converted. Like suddenly we just hear that Barnabas just kind of shows up. And Barnabas takes Paul in, and Barnabas joins Paul's ministry, and we don't really know much about what happened. We get these little hints like Lydia, but there's only a couple of actual conversions that we get to see in the Bible. And I think God did that on purpose. He wanted us to see the conversion of Saul of Tarsus in particular so that we understand how absolutely irresistible he is. And when we get done with this story, ask yourself, how much choice did Paul have? And how much will did he exert? And what did God do and what did Saul do? Okay, here's the first thing Saul did. Saul was busy being a really bad guy. I'll tell you now, you kids, in your life so far, you've yet to be as bad as this guy was. Saul of Tarsus, who would become Paul, who would write 2/3 of the New Testament, really bad man. People don't think that. You say, the Apostle Paul, everybody kind of puts a halo over the guy and says, well, the Apostle Paul, 2/3 of the New Testament after all, you know. Apostle Paul, who would write of himself, I am the chiefest of sinners. And people go, nah, he didn't mean that. No, not chiefest of sinners. He meant it. He was walking around killing and murdering people, which I doubt that any of you have done yet. Running around killing, and not just killing and murdering people, killing and murdering Christians. If he could find a Christian, he'd see to it that they got killed. That's Paul. Until God got a hold of him. By the way, you'll notice God did not show up and say, let me see if I can find a really good person who deserves it. He said, let me see if I can't find the chiefest of sinners who doesn't deserve anything, and I'll get him to write about my grace. That's the God I know. Kind of God that goes looking for people like me. Look at Acts 7, verse 58 real quick. This will give you a quick description of Paul. They're getting ready to kill Stephen. Stephen is one of the early converts to the church. Stephen's out there declaring Christ. And so they stone Stephen and kill him for being a Christian. And who's there at the stoning, making sure it goes well? Saul of Tarsus, of course. 58 says that they cast him out of the city and they stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at a young man's feet whose name was Saul. This is the first place that you hear of Paul in the Bible. Saul of Tarsus shows up right there and he's holding the robes so that the men can throw rocks harder. All the men who came to the stoning take off their robes and lay them at the feet of a guy who will protect the robes so that they can go kill Stephen. And who's the guy in charge of the robes so that the killing goes well? Paul. That's not a good guy. Flip over to chapter 8. Chapter 8 starts, and at that time there was a great persecution against the church which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And devout men carried Stephen, who had just been killed, to his burial, and they made great lamentation over him. But as for Saul, he made havoc of the church, and he entered every house, and hauling men and women, he committed them into prison. That's Paul. It said that he went house to house looking for Christians so that he could persecute them and throw them into prison. This is not a good guy. That's a bad guy. No halo over this guy's head. So go over to chapter 9 real quick. Starting at verse 1. And Saul, this same guy, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest. Look at that language. That's Luke writing, who traveled with Paul, who knew this stuff firsthand, said that Paul was riding around breathing out threats and slaughter. We don't think that way. Well, Paul, 2/3 of the New Testament, nice guy, good fellow. No, going house to house, slaughtering and threatening. That's what he was busy doing when God found him. People seem to think that when God finds you, you have to be in a church, usually near the front, preferably kneeling down on one of the front steps where there are lots of boxes of Kleenex so you can go on a crying jag, and then God will find you there. That's what people think, that that's how you find God, or how God finds you, and that God could not possibly find you in a bar, or that God couldn't possibly find you at your worst. He came and got Paul at his absolute worst. He came and got me at my absolute worst. I'll tell you that story someday. Maybe. I won't tell the kids. Came and got me at my absolute worst. Waited until I was at the bottom to say, "Hi, I'm God. I'll be using you for the rest of your life." And I went, "What? No, not me. You don't know me. I'm a mess." And he went, "No, I know you exactly. I know who I've chosen. Have I told you about Saul? He was a mess. I used him." Okay. Breathing out threatenings and slaughter as he went, and he desired from the high priest that he would give him letters so he could go to Damascus to the synagogues, and if he found any that were of this way, any that were Christians, whether they were men or women, he didn't care, men, women, children, didn't matter. If they were Christians, that he would bind them, that means put them in chains, put them in shackles, and drag them back here to stand in front of the high priest and be put in prison and killed for being Christians. That's a nice guy. And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven, and he fell down to the earth, and he heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Now, by the way, he hadn't yet persecuted Christ. He was busy persecuting women and children and men who said they loved Christ. But Jesus took it very personally. Turns out that when people persecute Christians, Jesus doesn't show up and say, "Why are you persecuting Bruce?" He says, "Why are you persecuting me?" Because Bruce belongs to Christ. And Christ takes it so personally that if you persecute those that belong to him, Christ says it's tantamount to persecuting him. So picture this. He's on his donkey. He's got all these men with him. He's got letters to Damascus from the high priest saying, "If I find, as I go home to home, any women, children, men who are Christians, I have the right to haul them back, bound in chains, take them back, put them in prison, make sure they die. I have all this." And a light comes down from heaven, knocks this guy off his donkey onto the ground, and a voice from heaven says, "Saul, why do you persecute me?" And the amazing part is all the people who were traveling with him, the company of people, didn't hear a thing. Why? Because Jesus was after Paul. He wasn't after everybody. He was only after Paul. Jesus didn't show up and convert the whole group. He converted Paul in the middle of the group. Isn't that remarkable? By the way, that's the way God always works. One by one, one person, very personal. "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And Saul said, "Who are you, Lord?" I like that. He said, "I don't know who you are, but I know that a light came down from heaven and you knocked me down, and I happen to be on the ground right now. And long as I'm down here in the dust, I will call you Lord." Seemed like a good choice, didn't it? He's out there persecuting Christ, but once he's knocked into the dirt, he knows that whoever did that is more powerful than he is. And he acquiesces to the power. And he said, "I am Jesus whom you persecute. It is hard for you to kick against the pricks." You know what that means? It's like a cattle prod. Anybody here got cows? When you can't get a cow to move when you want them to move, they have these little electrical shock sticks that they use to kind of give them a little goad. And you hit them and it goes zzz, and the cow moves again and gets moving again. That's a cattle prod. Same idea. He says, "Paul, I have been involved in your life, goading you along this whole time, and you have continued to resist and fight, resist and fight, resist and fight, and it's hard for you to continue this fight. It's time for you to give up. I win. I'm God. It's time for you to give up." By the way, have you had that experience? Have you had the time to give up experience? I have. Where you fight and you fight and you fight and you fight and, "No, I won't have this man rule over me. No, 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 no." Until you go, "You know what? This is harder than it ought to be. This is more difficult than it needs to be. I'd be better off if I just gave up. Just admitted that he's God and I'm not. turn my life over to Him and just ask Him, what is it you want? And whatever it is, I'll do it. That's what Paul did. And he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what will you have me do? Good question. Okay, you're here, you've knocked me down, you're tired of me persecuting you, and it is, it's hard to continue fighting against you. What do you want me to do? And he said, arise, go into the city, and it'll be told you what you should do there. I really like that part. Because we all are so into personal revelation that we all think that if God ever showed up, if Jesus ever showed up, that he would give us some personal revelation of what we should do with our lives. I had a guy write to me just this week who said, I can't figure out what it is God wants me to do for a job. I have two opportunities. I have this, I have that, and I don't know which one is God's will. And I wrote back and said, show me anywhere in the Bible where you find God showing up to any individual and telling them which toothbrush to use or which job to take or which... No, you walk by faith, not by sight. You walk through whatever door God opens today. You have no guarantee you'll be here tomorrow. And you are being saved by that constant hope that God is there in your life. As David would say, the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. You just keep walking. But you find nowhere, including here, Jesus talking to Paul. He says, what do you want me to do? And Jesus doesn't say, okay, here's the order of events. First, I'd like you to do this. Then, you're going to be writing 2/3 of the New Testament. Following that, we're going to, none of that. He says, go into the city and it'll be told you what to do. Act like a servant. Okay? He doesn't say, I'm going to tell you, and then you can go into the city and say, I saw Jesus, and Jesus told me what to do, like most of these guys on TV. Jesus met me this morning while I was brushing my teeth, and he told me to tell you what to do, which is remarkable. Like God couldn't come tell you what to do. He told me to tell you what to do. He came to Paul and said, act like a servant. You go into the city and it'll be told you what to do. Paul got no chance to get egoed out about the fact that he'd been met by Christ. Instead, he was put in the dust and told to be servile. I get tired of people who think that just because they've had an encounter with God, that somehow makes them greater than me or you. What? Same God saving us, and we're all servile. Once you've done everything that it was required of you to do, the end of it is, he said, you'll say, I'm just a servant. I've only done that which was my duty to do. Not enough servants in the church. Too many leaders. And the men that were journeying with him stood speechless, hearing a voice but seeing no man. They see Paul down there talking. They don't see anyone. But Paul's on the ground saying stuff like, well, what do you want me to do? And they're going, okay, Paul's flipped. Okay, Saul used to be okay, but he's down there on the ground talking to nobody now. Saul got up out of the earth, and when he opened his eyes, he couldn't see. He was blind. God blinded him and threw him down in the dust. Now let me ask you another question. Okay, so Saul's going around trying to kill people. God knocks him down, shines a light, speaks to him, blinds him, and tells him to go to the city. How much choice did Paul exert? None! And by the way, was the grace of God at that moment, though it didn't feel very gracious, I'm sure, to Paul at the moment, but it was the most gracious thing God had done in Paul's life, which was saving him. Did God's grace at that moment feel resistible to Paul? Did Paul stand up and say, oh no, I won't have you encroach on my free will. No, no, I will not do what you told me to do because my free will is more important than your plan. No, because God said, my word will not return to me void. It will accomplish that whereunto I sent it. And his word went to get Paul, and there was no way Paul was getting out. Saul rose up out of the earth. He opened his eyes. He couldn't see anything. So they led him by the hands and took him into Damascus. And he was there for 3 days without his sight. He didn't eat and he didn't drink. And there was a certain disciple at Damascus whose name was Ananias. And to him said the Lord in a vision, Ananias. And he said, behold, I'm here, Lord. And the Lord said to him, arise, go into the street, which is called Straight, and inquire at the house of Judas for one who is called Saul of Tarsus, for behold, he is praying, and he sees in a vision a man named Ananias coming in, putting his hand on him that he may receive his sight. And Ananias replied, Lord, I've heard many things about this man, how much evil he has done to the saints in Jerusalem. Look, Paul's reputation preceded him to the point where Ananias, remember, there's no TV, there's no radio, there's no telegraph, there's no way for this news to travel, and yet Saul was so evil that this guy Ananias already had heard about Saul and all the persecution Saul caused. That's how bad this Paul guy was. And he says, Lord, I've heard about this Saul guy. This is not a good man. This is not a good guy. I'm afraid of him. This is how bad this guy is. And God replies. He says, I know how much evil he's done to the saints in Jerusalem. Also here he has authority from the chief priests to bind them up, everyone who calls on your name. And the Lord said, go your way, because he, that evil, treacherous man, is a chosen vessel unto me. Oh, man, that's good news. That evil, slaughtering, threatening, treacherous man was a chosen vessel to God. For what purpose? To bear my name before the Gentiles, to bear my name before kings, and to bear my name before the children of Israel, for I will show him how great things he must suffer for my name's sake. Now, evil Paul was a whole lot worse than anybody in this room, I'd like to think. And his reputation spread far and wide as being a man who hated Christ and hated Christianity and was killing people for professing Christ. And yet God said, he's my chosen vessel. And he used that man to write 2/3 of the New Testament. And Paul certainly didn't seem to have any choice in the matter. And yet, 2,000 years later, we are still reading Paul's letters, still talking about Paul, still using Paul as our example, and still using Paul as our fundamental theology in the way that we approach Christ. And he was one bad guy. So, questions. Remember I said there were going to be questions at the end? Here we go again. We've already asked one of them. How much willpower did Paul exert in his transformation from evil, wicked guy to God's servant? How much willpower?
None.
No, God made him willing to do all his good pleasure. Now, how did he make him willing? He overpowered him. See, the Bible says, in the day of thy power, thy people will be willing. And that's fundamental. It's not that God shows up and makes you do something against your will. It's that God shows up and changes your will. It's that God gets a hold of you and says, I will cause you to do all my good pleasure. And not only that, I'll cause you to will to do all my good pleasure. That's what he did with Paul. So in the relationship between God and Paul, who had all the power? Now, what makes you think it's any different between you and God? This is the way God works. It's the way God represented himself as working. So what makes you think that when it's your turn to deal with God, that you're going to have the power to say no? The truth is, you're not going to have that power. He will overwhelm you, change your heart, change your will, and cause you to do all his good pleasure. And when we get tired of doing his good pleasure, he'll come along and say, it's hard for you to kick against the pricks, isn't it? You go, yes, okay. What will you have me do, Lord? Same question over and over. What will you have me do? You know, I've told you many, many times that I didn't like those, what would Jesus do stickers? And armbands and belts and t-shirts. And what would Jesus do? The implication being that you could somehow do what Jesus would do. One of my friends one time had one of those armbands on. What would Jesus do? And so I said, well, he'd raise the dead, and he'd heal the sick, and then he'd die for the sins of all his people. Go! Do what Jesus would do. That's not the proper question. The proper question is not, what would Jesus do? Because you can't do what Jesus would do. The proper question is the one Paul asked. What would you have me do? You can't do what Jesus would do, but you can do what you can do. And that's what he requires from you. You got that? So next time, you know, make an armband that says, what would Jesus have me do? That'd probably be too many letters. It wouldn't work as well on t-shirts. But what would Jesus have you do? That's the right question.